Thank you so much, Bobby. Let me invite the other speakers up. Thank you so much for that, Bobby. Oh, here comes Jonathan. Great. Lots of questions came in, and some from last night. Let me just, a couple of really specific ones coming out of your talk, and specifically thinking about 1 Corinthians 12. Somebody asked, look, couldn't you just remove the evildoer from your midst without official membership? Why is membership required to actually remove them?
Yeah, I think the first answer is that there's a real sense in which they weren't actually in the first place. Because think about what's the essence of the action Paul's telling them to take. I don't think the essence of church discipline is that a person can't attend church services. I think normally speaking, someone who's been removed from membership as an act of discipline should be welcome to continue attending church and even encouraged. By God's grace, we've seen a woman who was excommunicated for sexual immorality. She kept attending church. She was convicted. She repented. She's a flourishing member of our church now. And that happened in part through continuing to attend. So when Paul says remove the evildoer, he doesn't mean bar the assembly against them. There's outsiders who come in, 1 Corinthians 14. So what is it they're being put out of? I think in a way it's kind of a reality check. They simply weren't in the first place. That's the crucial issue. And I think further, this is where heightened sensitivities about things like abuse can actually be helpful here. What are you going to say to somebody? They've just been attending your church. You become aware of their, say, sexual immorality. You say, you're out of the church. First of all, who's saying it to them? Is it you as a pastor? Is it the whole congregation? How's the whole congregation supposed to act toward this person who's only come six times, or that they don't really know, or that they can't vouch that this person's a believer in the first place? I think some of those cultural heightened sensitivities about abuse kind of show us like that really would be heavy-handed. That really would be imposing a kind of penalty on somebody that they've not even signed up for in the first place. What do you mean? You can't charge me $100,000. I never signed up for your bizarro credit card in the first place.
Yeah.
This is fraud. This is a financial scheme. I don't owe you that money. I didn't sign up for this. I think there's a legit sense in which somebody could say, I never signed up for this. So that signing up for, it's a kind of granting of permission, granting of that authority. That whatever you do or don't have in terms of a formal process, that person has to be able to know, yeah, Brian's my pastor, this is the congregation. If they see this in me, they have this authority over me. The church has to know that, and I have to know that.
That's good. I think your exploration of culture like resonated with a lot of folks. So the question comes in, how do we as pastors and leaders recognize this and respond to it?
Yeah. A bigger challenge, when I talk to West Coast pastor friends, you guys, and I assume this is the case up here in the Pacific Northwest, you guys often have to have a lot of patience for people. You might have 80 members and 160 sort of total regular attenders. Mm-hmm. You just have way more people regularly attending than are willing to join. And I think that calls for a lot of patience and gentleness with people. I think it calls for recognizing there's some real default settings kind of set against it. We don't face that same exact default cultural setting in D.C. D.C. is like the most institutional city in America.
Yes.
So I do think patience, I think gentleness, but I think trying to gently move people toward it, help them try to see the fruits of it, kind of like smell the sweetness of it, you know, build relationships with church members, kind of get exposed to it. And I'd be curious for the brothers, especially Brian and Kyle,
to talk about that. Yeah. How are you all responding to this pastorally and helping people through it?
Remind me the question real quick.
Just recognizing that our culture's resistance to authority, it's baked in. So how do we recognize it? How do we pastorally help people through this?
Yeah, I think in our context, we're a smaller congregation and the majority of our gathering is members. And so there is something that membership is very normative for the people that regularly gather in our body, so that for somebody to begin regularly gathering who's not a member, one of the great apologetics for membership is the membership, right? That as they begin experiencing the kind of relationships that are forming within the congregation, as they experience the kind of warm hospitality, and then we just offer our membership class once every quarter and make that known. And because it's easier in a smaller church to identify people who have been attending who aren't members, someone can invite them very personally.
Right.
Hey, would you come to the class with no obligation to do anything so that I can show you what we're about, show you why we practice this, and try and make our best case for it. And so there's not just this like pressure necessarily that's applied, but the culture is promoting, creating a context where membership is normal and is seen as good.
Kyle, have you thought about this, experienced this in your context?
Yeah, I think a lot of the same things. I'm thinking of recently we were going through a membership class, which we publicly, you know, we will encourage people toward that. And even when I'm on Sunday mornings encouraging new attenders toward it, I say, this obligates you to nothing. This is us teaching you what the Bible talks about for you as a Christian, and you could do this anywhere. So we're trying to, in one sense, lower the bar and just say, if you're a believer, you want to grow in the things the scriptures call you to. But I think this gives people great comfort. I had a membership class, and we taught through much of what I did last night. I just do it in longer form, and some of the images Brian will get to later in the conference. But we had a woman in her 70s, a non-believer, end that class and tell one of our members who was there with her to try to kind of disciple her through it, 70-some-year-old woman, and she said, I want a family like that. Mm-hmm. And now they're having discussions about baptism. But what was attractive was the idea that a body of people could live like this in this sort of care and love.
One of the questions that's come in related to that is then, as pastors, as elders, and just general leaders in the church, how do we think about relating to folks that are coming regularly and just refusing to join? What obligations do we have to them as pastors and leaders? How do we think about the use of our time in relation to them, et cetera? I mean, I don't know about your churches. I have a group of people in my church, you might even be here today, who attend faithfully every Sunday and have for over a decade and will not join because they are, despite the teaching, they are opposed to the idea of membership. So what do you do?
Even we have a few of those.
Even we
have a few of those.
It encourages me.
I've got names and faces.
Yeah.
I think, within reason and kind of reading the situation, gently seeking to persuade them. But of course, you run out of persuasion eventually. They're just settled in their mind. I think being kind and gracious to them, praying that they'll profit from the ministry of the word. And I would just say we're deep into territory of prudence. You know, if there's some particular need that arises or some way you can minister to them, great. But I do think there's a real difference in terms of the resources of the church, kind of who's available, who's getting prayed for. We as elders are praying regularly for every single member. We're not habitually sending out emails and finding out what's going on in this person's life who's been sitting in that same chair for 10 years. And I think there is a limit, not to be unkind, but just to say that that part of what they're doing is opting out of a crucial aspect of the church's provision.
Yeah.
Yes, be gracious, be kind, encourage them gently as they can. But let me show you one place I reached a limit. There's a guy who I had been coming for years. His name is Mike. I don't know if he's still going to your church or not.
He is indeed.
Still not a member?
He is not.
So this is like 10, 15 years ago. And
yeah.
If he's watching this, I'm content to have this conversation. I doubt he's watching it. I went to lunch with him, and I was like, hey, have you thought about joining the church? And he's like, well, no, I have certain concerns about what you guys are requiring for baptism. I don't know if I agree with that. Like, I agree with you, you think on baptism, but that you'd require that. So he and I talked through it, and we resolved it. Went to another lunch with him. I said, hey, have you thought about where you at now with joining the church? And he said, well, you know, some of the stuff you guys say about God's sovereignty and your statement of faith, I'm just not really sure we should. So we worked through that. Finally, on a third lunch, which I wouldn't typically go to three lunches with a guy in this situation, but whatever, I did. Finally, on the third lunch, he made it clear that he hadn't joined the last church before us because of certain objections, and the church before that he hadn't joined because of certain objections. So he's a really sharp guy, theologically, right? But he kind of likes to argue a little bit. And so finally I said to him, listen, I'd encourage you to stop taking the Lord's Supper. That's not an act of excommunication. I don't have the authority to do that. That's just a word from another Christian, a pastor. encouraging you that you're kind of the captain of your own ship. If you're living in self-deception, how would you ever know it? You could be completely deceived. And so I would encourage you, and that's part of what we'll talk about the supper after lunch. That's part of what the supper is for. So I'd encourage you to abstain. And interestingly, as I said, he's a sharp guy. He said, well, in fact, I have abstained. I haven't taken it for years. And I said, that's really sad, but I think it's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there does come a limit when I think you just say,
Right. Okay, moving a slightly different direction then.
I've only had that conversation once or twice. I'm not doing that all the time, just to be clear.
Watch out if Jonathan invites you to lunch, hey?
Yeah, seriously. Particularly that third lunch. That third lunch. Okay, moving a slightly different direction. Is there language as leaders in the church, or as church members, is there language that we might be using, or practices that we might have put in place in our church, that without us even thinking about it, is actually undermining the kind of meaningful membership that we're talking about here? One person asks about like multiple services, for example. Does that undermine a meaningful membership? Are there other things that we should be thinking about?
I think one is simply the language you use to talk about who we are as a church. And I can think of a church that I belonged to at one time that did have formal membership and did mean to practice it carefully, but there was a kind of like studied minimizing and sort of blurring over and blending over the way we would talk about who we are. Mm-hmm. Member didn't really show up. You were never made to feel outside of anything if you weren't a member. There was no like verbal, you know, roadblock or road sign to be like, oh, wait a minute. I guess maybe, you know, they'd have a membership class, but it was very kind of like, you know, if you want to, hands off. So I do think there's ways that you as a pastor feel. I'm kind of like erecting a potential little hurdle in front of somebody or minimizing it. Mm-hmm. And I think actually you want to use language that publicly draws that line. That's a kindness. That's a service. That's a way you can help people become self-aware about this who haven't yet been. And they might even just kind of notice, wait a minute, they kind of talk about members here a lot. What's going on there? Or you talk that way, then your members start to talk that way, and they ask people, oh, I think I've seen you around here a little bit. Are you a member? Can you let me know? And that becomes a little bit of a gentle pressure from a kind of 360-degree direction, that it's not just you as a pastor saying it, but your people kind of expect, oh, I'll relate to you differently. So even just being deliberate about the language of member versus not, I think goes a long way.
Yeah. Other thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have people serve in any formal way if they're not a member. Obviously, if somebody was attending and we ate something and they picked up a broom and they weren't a member, we wouldn't be like, put that down, you know? But in terms of who's scheduled to serve, who's in a ministry, they have to be a member. Yeah. When we have members meetings, now early on when membership was new, since I was leading a church revitalization, people who had been with the church for a long time, but membership was new to them, I let them attend a few of the members' meetings to begin understanding what it was. But at this point, when we have members' meetings, we have a list of the members' names, and you have to sign in as a member to be there. And if you're not a member, we let you know you're welcome to hang out with us a little bit after, but once our members' meeting starts, we would ask you to leave. Okay. So there's activities that we do that only members get to participate in.
Yeah. Kyle?
One of the things that I wanted to throw in, and I think Bobby mentioned this, but the language, I found it very helpful for my congregation that when I'm preaching through, I mean, especially look at the New Testament epistles, that my language, as I'm exhorting them to obey Scripture, is the language of member to member, not Christian to Christian. Mm. I mean, think of 1 Corinthians 12. Bobby quoted this verse about that God so composed the body that there may be no division, but that's a division of care, and they know for whom they're supposed to care. And so when you're preaching things like that, to start talking in the language of member to member and member responsibilities, I think goes a long way to sort of forward this in your congregation.
That's good. Were you going to add something, Jonathan?
I was going to say, anything that you require of your church that's not biblical or a form of what's biblical, to create something larger and more elaborate than what's in the Bible, I think that can ultimately undermine membership. I mean, I could give examples, but you know, I think that does. I do think multi-site and multi-service does it. I think elder rule
actually
fires your church members, as somebody once said, yes, and can undermine it.
I want to make a plug for all of you out there to stop calling this thing that we're standing on a stage. Because when you call it a stage, it turns you into what? An audience, and we're performers. And now you're here as a consumer. So I think actually if you're going to create a culture of meaningful membership, it means even thinking that specifically about the language that you're using. Because as you use language, you're creating reality. You're defining and labeling things, whether you know it or not. It's a platform. And this is an auditorium. It's a place where you've come to hear people speak. But it's this is not a sanctuary, and this is not a stage. Yeah.
Just to riff on that point for a second, the reason I like the architecture of this room is it allows people to sing to one another, right? We planted our church in 2018, and we're in an elementary school gym right now. And when I walked in the very first day, somebody put all the chairs in a straight line looking towards the front, and I came in my own presumptuous sort of way and kind of rearranged the chairs so they would V a little bit, and we'd be facing one another, and then the person changed them back, but okay. I tried.
Yeah, no, and so sometimes... And
those are congregational instincts in me.
Right, and I'm sure your churches do this too, but sometimes we'll have this side of the room sing to that side of the room, and vice versa, or responsive or congregational readings where we're reading scripture back and forth to each other. Small things like that change the culture because all of a sudden you're not the audience that's being entertained, but your members, yeah.
I can be kind of annoying on this, but I think it matters is if somebody does the welcome in the beginning and they say, welcome to Saving Grace Church, I'm gonna be like, please don't
say that.
Yeah, welcome to this gathering of Saving Grace Church. I don't wanna use language that regularly implies that the building that we meet in is the church, and then it's just a place that you attend, but it's a people that we're a part of, and we intend to speak of the church in that kind of way. Saving Grace, my name is Brian. I don't serve as one of the pastors here. I serve as one of the pastors to this congregation.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. That's really important. And we are out of time for questions for this one, but I haven't lost any ones that you've sent in, and I didn't get to any of the hot questions this time. Oh yeah, they're coming. So we're gonna take a 15-minute break, and we will be back again at the top of the hour.